Welcome to TechNation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today on TechNation Health, efforts to detect Alzheimer's disease early, well before any observable symptoms appear. And our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, tells us that the ability to control technology with our voice is impacting medicine. It's an unfortunate fact that Alzheimer's disease is well established long before any outward symptoms appear. Is it possible that we might better identify those who are already on the path to Alzheimer's? Carlo Medici is the CEO of Alzeca.
Moira, this is a very good question, and I want to start with a piece of data which is stunning in my opinion. $7.9 trillion is the potential cost savings for the U.S. population for early diagnosis of Alzheimer's. This is from the 2018 Facts and Figures Alzheimer's Association report. So we could save almost $8 trillion if we were able to detect Alzheimer's early. So how do we detect it if there are no symptoms? So today, nowadays, biomarkers, signals in the body that show the changes in the brain are used instead of clinical symptoms. And the signals or biomarkers are many, and among them, there are two, the formation and accumulation of amyloid plaques and the formation and accumulation of tau tangles.
Plaques and tangles.
Amyloid, plaques, and tangles that are used to detect the pathophysiological changes in the brain that eventually lead to memory loss, confusion, what is called mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, and then dementia, mild, moderate, and severe dementia.
Is there any way we can detect those today?
Yes. Amyloid plaques are detectable using a imaging modality called PET. Positron emission tomography. There are three PET imaging tests approved by the FDA. And tau tangles are under development using the same modality, PET. However, PET has some limitations. It is not radiation free. One PET scan is equivalent to 40-70 chest x-rays, a massive amount of radiation for patients exposed to it. PET is very expensive. Anywhere between $4,000 to $6,000 a scan. And PET is not available everywhere. Actually, it's available in tertiary care hospitals, academic centers, and PET is nowadays a rate-limiting factor in enrolling patients in clinical trials because, again, it's not everywhere. So alternative modalities are being studied, among which MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is certainly very promising. And Alzeca is developing an assay for amyloid detection using MRI. MRI has no radiation, zero. It's less expensive, about one-fifth of a PET scan, and it's much more available, widely available, compared to PET. In the U.S., there are approximately 10 MRI scans for one PET scan. But if you go to other countries that are not as developed as the U.S., or where MRI is not as widely used as in the U.S., that ratio goes much higher. It's 20 to 50, you know, MRI for one PET. In some countries, there is one or two PETs in the entire country. So you can imagine that this is going to be very limiting. There are other issues with PET that are more technical. And we should not forget that MRI is the modality of choice in imaging for neuro. So if you have for the brain. So if you have a suspicion of a tumor or a trauma, and it's used to rule out, you know, other causes of dementia today. It's not used to rule in, so to diagnose Alzheimer's, because we need an imaging assay like the one Alzeca is developing that really binds specifically to the misfolded proteins, such as the amyloid plaques or the tau tangles. And this is what our company is doing. We're in preclinical, and we hope to be in humans by the end of next year.
Now, many people aren't familiar with the word assay, and what it means is that
it's a test.
It's a test, but you have to inject something into the human.
Yes. So as opposed to a blood test, you know, where you get your blood drawn and then You don't know what's going on, but somebody in the laboratory is testing your blood and seeing whether there is like, you know, a glucose, what is the level of glucose. An imaging assay is really a like a drug that is injected in your body and it goes through the blood system. And then, you know, you go through an MRI scan, an MRI is performed, and then you can see with our test, you know, the amyloid plaques in the brain.
So does it go into your brain? Does it?
Yes.
It crosses the blood-brain barrier?
Well, it does two things. One, it goes through the choroid plexus, and which is part of the part of you know, an entryway to the brain.
Okay.
And it's carried by the cerebrospinal fluid or CSF into the brain.
Uh-huh.
And in Alzheimer's patients, it's known that the blood-brain barrier is leaky. And so it goes through the blood-brain barrier too. So there are two ways whereby our liquid, our test, you know, goes to the brain. And once it's in the brain, you know, there is a molecule that specifically binds, attaches to the amyloid plaques. And then when you do the MRI, it lights up.
And so you're seeing, the plaques because it got into the brain and it attaches.
And basically sticks to the plaques. And then when you do the MRI, you see it. You see the brain and you see lightening up, you know.
And you see the leaky part because it got into the brain.
Exactly.
And all of that points to you're on your way, unfortunately.
Well, it's amazing.
To Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and, you know, there is often the question, so what when you see the amyloid plaques or the tau tangles? Well, recently there was a task force of the National Institute on Imaging and the Alzheimer's Association that issued a framework whereby they classify these biomarkers, these signals, into three categories. And basically, when you have the amyloid and the tau, this is an indication of a likely progression to the continuum of Alzheimer's disease, to dementia. And what is very fascinating is that, you know, the use of biomarkers would allow this diagnosis to be done way before the clinical symptoms appear. And then in the presence of so-called disease-modifying drugs that many pharmaceutical companies are developing, not one has been approved by the FDA yet, but there is, you know, high hope that in the next few years there will be one or more drugs approved. Then you could intervene early. You know, imagine a 45-year-old patient with no symptoms but a family history of Alzheimer's, undergoing a relatively inexpensive, no radiation MRI. He or she has amyloid plaques, and he or she gets put on drug, maybe a low dose, and eventually doesn't develop Alzheimer's, doesn't develop dementia. Would that be amazing?
In addition to which, our Alzheimer's drugs have been going after end-stage patients. We actually could pull them all back to see what do you do on early-stage patients.
Well, Moira, that's a very, very good point. The research is focused more and more on early detection, early intervention. Because there is a mounting amount of scientific evidence, then intervening late is too late. I mean, it's kind of intuitive, but there is also a body of research now showing that you got to intervene early in the preclinical stage or when the memory loss and confusion is really mild beginning, and then you can really change the course of the disease. So stop the accumulation of these proteins that eventually lead to the neurodegeneration cascade.
Typically, people think that if it's a diagnostic, well, you can get this to market early because it's just a diagnostic. But because of the fact you inject your fluid, if you will, into the body, they're treating it as if it were a drug.
Yes, the FDA, rightfully so, treats an imaging agent, which, as you pointed out, is injectable, so it's injected in the human body as a drug for all intents and purposes. Actually, there is a division within the FDA called the Imaging Division that is part of CDER, which is the branch of the FDA that approves drugs. The only difference is that you're not curing, so the hurdle to prove efficacy is lower. But you have to make sure that the drug is safe, no harm, and you have to go through all the phases 1, 2, and 3 of clinical development, and then you have to submit the so-called NDA, new drug application, and get approval by the FDA. And that takes anywhere between 5 to 7 years.
So where are you in the whole arc of this?
We are still early. We're in the preclinical stage, and we are going to submit the so-called IND, Investigational New Drug Application, to the FDA sometime mid-next year in order to be permitted to inject into humans. And after that, we start the phase 1 study, which we plan to begin in quarter 4 of next year. So we'll inject into humans in quarter 4 of next year, and that will give us a very early indication of safety on one hand and efficacy. I mean, it works in humans and it detects the amyloid plaques sometime in quarter 1 of 2020.
Well, Carlo, thank you so much for coming in. I hope you'll come back. Keep us updated.
Absolutely. Thank you, Moira. Have a great, wonderful day.
Carlo Medici is the CEO of Alzeca. More information is available at alzeca.com. That's A-L-Z-E-C-A, alzeca.com. So many of us now are speaking to our smartphones, our Alexas, and Google Homes and Echo Dots, you name it. I asked our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, has the ability to use voice made its way into the medical field?
Well, voice as a interactive platform is absolutely exploding, and all the big tech players are competing, from Amazon Alexa now to Google Home. Everybody's got a voice platform. And speaking of, as a physician interested in the future of health and medicine, there are absolutely tremendous needs and use cases that health can use with voice. You know, one example is the fact that the average provider, let's say doctor, needs to complete 20,000 forms a year. That's a lot of form filling.
What?
they often have 4 or more, you know, admins per provider.
They're form fillers, outer. They're not doctors.
Yeah, that's part of the challenge. We're filling out forms. We're typing notes on computers, electronic medical records. All are very sort of type and text heavy. That leads to lots of mistakes. Administrative errors, by some accounts, are number three or four leading cause of big challenges and problems and even deaths in hospitals. So voice, which now is our sort of primary way of communicating, it's easy, it doesn't take a lot of cognitive load, is being unleashed. And it's being unleashed as, you know, the primary interface for healthcare. And, you know, there's several sort of interesting applications that you can think about. One is just listening to our voice. The idea of voice as a biomarker. You can tell from my voice if I'm stressed, if I'm tired, if I'm drunk, if I have a cold. There are now several companies that have started to do analytics and apply machine learning and AI to listen to our voice and understand, is that the sound of someone who's depressed and talking slow, or manic or excited or schizophrenic? Or are there changes in the voice that happen if someone's developing a disease like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, or even changes in heart disease can be picked up in voice. So that's one sort of element, not just the words, but the context and the tonalities. And then, of course, there's our ability to use voice as an interface, not just to text a message, but use that in a clinical environment. For example, a surgeon in the operating room might want to be hands-free and not be getting unsterile, or using a voice checklist to make a procedure easier, or a patient sitting in a hospital bed, instead of trying to press that call button and talk to the little box, can talk to the sort of AI digital assistant, or a patient or a consumer before they even get to a hospital can use AI chatbots that are voice enabled to listen to their symptoms and decide whether they even need to go see a clinician. So there's a variety of applications, and some of them are going to become increasingly important, particularly, you know, in the home environment. We can use voice to remind an older patient to take their medicines, even a younger patient. We could use it to listen for sounds of a fall and get them help. You know, they don't even need to say, "Alexa, help, I've fallen, I can't get up." They may listen and hear that fall. So what we're seeing today is hospital systems, pharma companies, electronic medical record systems start to apply voice as a platform in many interesting novel ways.
If there's one thing you really need, is when you're a mother or a parent or a caregiver and you need help right now and you've got both hands full, you're trying to deal with something and you're like, I don't know what to do. It seems to me you want to say, Alexa, what should I do? Is that even possible, or is that just sort of made up out of thin air?
It's a perfect unmet need or pain point, and it's already being approached and solved. So one of my friends is John Brownstein. He's the head of innovation at Boston Children's Hospital, one of the leading innovators in the voice space. Has a whole platform called voice.health, so go to voice.health to learn some more. And at Boston Children's, they've pioneered developing apps, one called KidsMD, that you can put on Alexa. And if you're a harried parent and you've got a screaming toddler with a fever, you can ask KidsMD, you know, how much Tylenol do I need to give? Or ask other basic pediatric health questions, and you'll get some smart answers that can enhance care and maybe de-stress the child-parent relationship.
And I think finally, you know, while you did mention stress, there are all manner of emotional states that you can have. Is that really helpful to be able to sense that?
Well, we know that, you know, mental health is such a burden and challenge. And if you can get early biomarkers to someone's change in their mental state, you could potentially do early intervention and prevention. Now, we're talking on our phones all the time or to our, you know, voice assistants, and they might learn Daniel's baseline or Moira's baseline. And you're talking on your phone and you're sounding agitated. It might give you or your loved one a little note saying, hey, Daniel, you seem like you're a little out of sorts today. Maybe it's time to go do a meditation session or take a
and
walk.
And then when you smash the phone, you'll know that it's true. I'm really out of sorts.
There's a company in Israel called Beyond Verbal, and they've created this little app anyone can download, which enables you to listen to your own emotional states in real time. And not just your emotional states. Are you afraid? Are you hiding something? So, you know, all these sorts of platforms may be useful diagnostically to pick up signs of depression or other mental health changes and enable someone to act early. Maybe that's taking a walk or changing your antidepressant. It may start to give us ways in ethically challenged ways. You're doing a Skype session and you're listening in on someone. Are they really telling the truth? All the way to doing early prediction of significant diseases like Alzheimer's, where if voice is a biomarker can pick that up, it might lead to further diagnostics and enable a patient to take early prevention that might stave off that disease.
And usually in the early stages, especially if you're living by yourself, you can do a lot of covering for some of the problems that you're having. Mm-hmm. And if that could be picked up in your voice, you can get there. You can get solutions faster.
The whole idea, I think, we've talked about on the show is to be more proactive and do that earlier rather than waiting for, you know, the stage 3 or stage 4 of disease to unleash. And as we're starting to, you know, privacy is important. So we're starting to measure voice in the real home setting. It's one thing if you're sending a text message or recording on a Facebook platform, but if you're starting to listen to these sounds, we start to pick up what are the changes in voice or other sound elements that are happening in a home environment or a clinical environment, and use that to give clues or guidance. We can be more personalized and proactive and preventative.
And just like you can turn off the ringer on your phone from whatever time you want, 10 p.m. to 8 a.m., whatever it is, you can turn off the fact they're listening to you. Privacy is not about just everybody else finding out what you do. It's like, I don't want it recorded. I don't want it analyzed.
And privacy is certainly a critical issue. And we've seen society change, you know, with CCTVs, which initially people were very uncomfortable with. Now they're everywhere. We don't even notice them. So we're being visually recorded in almost every public setting. So there's positive and dark sides to any technology. One of the things that's getting interesting with voice is it's being blended with AI and machine learning. And one of the challenges that we talked about in the clinical environment is we have to keep typing our notes and filling out forms. Now there are several startups who are developing sort of automated transcription systems so they can listen to my interaction with a patient and start to write my note for me. And basically, I might just sign off at the end. So several companies are building these sort of smart AI listening scribes that can help a nurse, a doctor, any kind of clinician to kind of have their notes written on the fly in the cloud. And voice is this great example of these exponential technologies coming together, you know, cloud, cheap sensors, mobile, big data, AI, and the fact that it's globalizing. You know, when we heard the first iPhones in 2007, they were neat. They had a few apps. But when they really became valuable is when these sort of app stores, the App Store, the iTunes Store developed. And now, you know, there's tens of thousands of apps in healthcare alone. Now we're starting to see in voice that same element that even you and I, without any coding experience, can build a health app or any other kind of voice-enabled app or skill that can democratize the sort of innovation around the planet.
In fact, with us doing all these interviews over time, you know, I've got now 25 years of my voice and you've many years of your voice now. It's like people can study that voice over time.
We can study it and we could create the sort of artificial Moira voice engine, and you might not need to show up in the studio. You could...
Well, they don't need me anymore.
and many people, voice is endemic to our personality. It's our identity in many cases, even if you're not on the radio. Certain patients lose their ability to talk, folks with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. And now some of the work at Boston Children's and elsewhere are starting to build sort of a voice bank where if you're losing your voice, you could record it and bank it and then be able to communicate with your own voice instead of some computer synthesized robot engine. So this is an important kind of combination, bringing people back their own individuality and humanity by being able to recreate their voices in a clinical setting with ALS or potentially to create our future podcasts and radio shows.
I'm telling you, they won't need us much, Dana. I'll tell you.
Everything's going absolutely.
But it's been so nice knowing you. So thanks a lot, Daniel.
Thanks, Myra.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.